Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, we talk with the Archbishop of Washington, D.C. about the impact of Pope Benedict's visit to the United States. And we take a step inside the Holy See's mission to the United Nations to see how the Pope's message gets across to a global audience. Pope Benedict XVI is back in the Vatican after a whirlwind trip to the United States that took him to New York, the United Nations, and Washington, D.C. His visit was packed with meetings and events. I asked Archbishop Donald Wuerl of the nation's capital how the media reacted to the visit and what they picked up on most.
Well, I think two points came across. One was a very, very positive one. I think the media were surprised at the warmth of the reception of the Holy Father, of the affectionate outpouring for him, and how he was able to connect so easily with the crowds of people that met him. Let me give you one small example. At Andrews Air Force Base on the day of his arrival, all the cameras were all focused on him as he came down the steps from the plane and then was greeted by the President of the United States. The Pope was smiling, waving, but the people that were at the airport, at the Air Force Base, responded with an enormous outpouring of affection. But this is the point. The next morning, as I went to join the motorcade that was to go from the hotel where the papal party was staying to the nunciature to join the Pope, one of the housekeepers at the hotel said to me, "I saw the Pope on television last night. It is clear that he loves us." I was very touched by that. The Holy Father is able to communicate his warmth and his care and his concern for us in a unique manner. And it was evident throughout his visit. Watching the crowds along Pennsylvania Avenue as he went by in the Pope Mobile after his visit with the President, watching the crowds as he drove in the Pope Mobile from the conference of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops office to the National Shrine where he met the bishops. It was evident that he was connecting with these people in a very beautiful, personal manner.
Did you get the feeling that the media were ready to be a bit on the antagonistic side ahead of this trip and that they basically came around to more of a positive view of this trip?
I think that is a very good way to put this. I think all the stories that led up to his coming to the States, so many of them had this overtone that there was a certain sense of apprehension. Many of the articles spoke about his coming to scold. Although I have to say, it's also true that a good number of the articles did say that the Holy Father will be coming primarily to encourage the faithful. But I think the shift took place when he arrived and everybody saw that he was here as a pastor of souls, not someone who was here to scold. And that began to be picked up in the print media, in the electronic media, and I think that refrain has gone through his visit up until his departure from New York. There was a shift in the way media perceive the Holy Father, at least in a good part of the public media.
Now, in almost every public encounter while there in the U.S. The Holy Father alluded to the suffering of the U.S. church caused by the sex abuse crisis and the need for purification and healing. Were you surprised that he would place so much emphasis on this problem in his public discourses?
I think we all anticipated that the Holy Father would speak to this issue, and it was a blessing that he did, because it was a sign of his care and also his solidarity with the bishops as we try to bring healing to this very, very serious wound, a wound that we have addressed and are now trying not only to ensure that it doesn't happen again, but to bring healing to people who did suffer. I think there was some surprise that it was mentioned as often, but then again, the Holy Father was speaking first to the media, then to the bishops, and then to all of the faithful, and then to a gathering of priests. So I think he was trying to speak to every identifiable group to say two things, to say that we need to continue to reach out to victims and to help them heal, and that we need to be vigilant that this never happens again. But it certainly dominated the coverage, particularly in Washington, because that's where he also met with victims. And so it simply cast a tone to the entire visit by making that the headline story every day.
I've been following some of the U.S. media over here in Italy, and I've found that some U.S. commentators have said, yes, it's all very well that the Pope was so upfront about the abuses, but it's another matter altogether for the Church to actually prevent it from happening again. Do you think that we're going to see any kind of a shakeup in the U.S. Church in response to this child abuse problem after the Pope's visit?
Well, we have to remember that this is an issue that was addressed already. This was addressed 6 years ago. The issues that we're hearing about, the cases of people who are coming forward to say they were abused, happened decades ago. When it became clear that this was a serious problem in the church, and when it surfaced, the bishops of the United States addressed this with great firmness. The first effort was already back in 1993, and then when it was clear that the response hadn't been as effective as we had hoped, the meeting in Dallas of the bishops resulted in a charter, and eventually the Holy See provided essential norms that allowed us to enforce that charter. So we're talking about action that was taken already 5 or 6 years ago. Seeing that none of these priests were in ministry, seeing that there was a healing process in place, a counseling program for anyone who had been abused, and an outreach to them. This is essentially a matter that took place years ago.
In preparing a radio address in the United States, the Pope apparently was recorded as saying that he had come to confirm his brothers and sisters in the faith in the United States, but he concluded by saying, "I have to say that American Catholics are confirming me in my faith." What does that say about the Holy Father's impression of this trip and the U.S. Church?
I think that's one of the really beautiful aspects of this whole experience of the Pope's apostolic journey to the United States. We anticipated that he would come and confirm us in the faith, that he would come and that he would be with us also to challenge us. It's not just a matter of confirming us, but also to challenge us to live out the faith. And he did that. In fact, in his homily at Washington National Stadium, he says, "He began, in the exercise of my ministry as a successor of Peter, I have come to America to confirm you, my brothers and sisters, in the faith of the apostles." Well, he did that, and he did it beautifully well. He did it with compassion, kindness, with joy. Everywhere he went, confirmed us in the faith. I think he was also pleased to find that the faith is so strong. I heard him say a number of times how strong the faith is that he was witnessing in front of him on his visit. So I think it was a two-way street. He was confirming us, and we were affirming for him that we are, in fact, a strong, vibrant, and faithful church.
Archbishop Donald Wuerl of Washington, D.C. Well, you'd be forgiven if you didn't know that the Vatican is also represented at the United Nations in New York. I didn't know until I came to work for Vatican Radio. Neither did Monsignor James Reinert, who only found out when he was called to work in the Holy See's office there back in the late 1990s. Now an officer at the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, Monsignor Reinert told me about what the Vatican's office at the UN does, and above all, why the Holy See has chosen to hold permanent observer status rather than full membership in the UN.
We're an observer country in the United Nations, an observer state, that the Holy See has chosen that this is the status that it wants to maintain. There would be nothing that would keep it from becoming a member should the Holy See, should the Holy Father decide to become full members of the United Nations. Observer status allows the Holy See to participate in meetings. It allows them to join in the debate, join in negotiations for different documents, resolutions coming out. But it then keeps us from voting, the ability to block a movement within the UN. We can't object to a resolution being forwarded because of that status. And from what I understand from my own experience, that we have chosen, the Holy See has chosen to be an observer, because then we don't get involved with some things that we can't, as Holy See, become involved with. If there would be a vote on going to war, a vote on sanctions, these kind of things that would be expected of a member, the Holy See would then choose not to be part of that. And so we keep the observer status.
Yet, when talking of a war, especially a war that the Holy See does not think is justified, you'd think that the Holy See would want to pose an objection or vote against a measure for a war.
Certainly, but there would be also times when we join in the discussion, but if it comes down to being as a member, then becoming a member of the Security Council, for instance, there would be times when a vote would be expected and a vote would have to be taken on certain issues that the Holy See wouldn't involve itself with.
What other countries are simply observers at the UN?
Palestine has observer status, and that's all. In the past, I think it was about 2002, up until that time, Switzerland was an observer also, and the Swiss government decided to take on full membership, and so they are a member state. So it's right now the Holy See, which is a permanent observer state, and Palestine, which is a permanent observer. There's a slight difference in the nuance there.
Of course, also, Palestine is not an internationally recognized state as such.
As such.
Though not everyone will agree with what the Pope has to say in today's world, he's nevertheless considered one of the world's most powerful moral voices. Could you say, in a sense, that the Pope's office to the UN, the Holy See's office, gives voice to this moral conscience on a global level? And what sort of issues did you typically deal with when you were at the New York headquarters?
Well, it's important, and you mentioned the New York headquarters, to also realize that we're present in the UN offices in Paris, at UNESCO, in Vienna, in Geneva, and Nairobi, at the environmental offices. So it's not just New York. And yes, the voice of the Holy See is seen as a moral voice for these issues. We don't get into the political debate, but we ring the bell when we see something that this isn't right, ethically, morally. Maybe something needs to be changed, something needs to be discussed or debated. And we always have seen that as the most important role of the Holy See within the United Nations system.
Can you give me some examples of maybe some issues that you worked on when you were there in New York? And did people take the Holy See's comments or observations seriously?
we always had a voice, and it was heard. Maybe it wasn't listened to all of the time, but it was heard. One of the things, it didn't happen in my time, it happened just before I arrived in 1995, but the Cairo Conference. And had it not been for the work of the Holy See...
On population.
Population and development. Mm-hmm. If it hadn't been for the Holy See and the allies that it brought to the fight, the Latin American countries, many of the Muslim countries, abortion would probably have been declared a human right at that conference. And people recognized then, and continue to recognize it, it was the role of the Holy See that thwarted that and many other issues related to contraception and reproductive health and abortion. Other than that, sanctions, economic sanctions, we've always been a voice against unilateral sanctions that harm the common people, the people on the ground. Many other issues. We were involved with all of the issues that were discussed, some not as much as others, but certainly on the social and economic spheres, in disarmament, in peace building, those sort of issues, that we were very much involved in and continue to be involved in those things.
I know one of the things that you worked on in the past was maritime treaties and seabed treaties.
That the question would be asked, what are you doing here at these meetings? What interest does the Holy See have? But that was always a good example of letting people know that, yes, we didn't have a political or economic interest in this, but we saw our role as making sure that things were done fairly for the developing countries, for countries that might not also have had a direct interest in this, but wanted to be at the table. And so the Holy See was able to give voice to a number of people, organizations, countries that may not have had a voice in those things.
Of course, those issues are quite important because many countries today are interested in deep sea excavation for oil and other minerals. People stand to gain economically from this, don't they?
The Holy See was involved with that because we saw the seabed as the common heritage of everyone. If I lived in a landlocked country, I really wouldn't have an interest in what was going on in the open ocean. And so the Seabed Authority was created, and that's just one example of many organizations that came out of the UN, to make sure that when that seabed was being exploited, mining or oil or whatever it might be, that all countries would share in the benefits of it, not just the ones who are actually doing the drilling or the mining, that all countries would share in the profits that were coming from what was considered all of our heritage.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned sanctions a minute ago. Did you deal with issues such as ongoing sanctions against Cuba? But what countries come to mind? And what are the reasons really behind the Holy See's position against sanctions and embargoes?
Well, we're not opposed to sanctions and embargoes. I'm sure that we would have been in favor is the wrong word, but the sanctions that brought down the apartheid regime in South Africa would have been seen as a beneficial thing. And there are big sanctions and little sanctions, and they would be discussed in two places in the UN, once in the second committee, the Economic Committee of the General Assembly, and also in the Security Council. Now, I myself was never involved with a meeting in the Security Council, but I would participate in the discussions in the second committee, and we would usually make a statement, the Holy See would make a statement against unilateral sanctions that were harmful to an economy beyond forcing a government to change. And yes, Cuba would come up, Iran, Libya. There are a number of countries that have various sanctions imposed upon them. If the UN was going to do it, we would be supportive to the point of, if it's going to make a real change, if there's going to be a time limit on this, if it's going to be lifted, if there's a chance that something will come from this, the Holy See would support that. But it's those that become harmful to the population with no time limit, that are just ongoing, those we would have opposed.
And as observers, are you given the same opportunities as members to state your position?
They have speakers lists. You get yourself on the list and you make your statement when it comes your turn. That was one of the things that I was involved with, was formulating which topics we would make a formal statement on, and then arranging for the time and the date for those statements to be made.
What was your specialty exactly there in that office?
Whatever they told me to do. My background is in education. I covered mostly economic issues, the second committee, but I was also involved with many of the social development issues, children, education, health, women, trade, those sorts of things. The environment came under the second committee, economic development issues, sustainable development issues. That's 90% of what I did following those concerns.
Did you have a favorite part of your job that you really liked? Or maybe somewhere that you felt you really made an impact?
In the discussions, in a meeting like the Commission on Social Development, where they would find a particular topic, and that would be the discussion this session, this year. And if it was something that I not only was interested in, but there was a real concern for the church, education, healthcare. One year we discussed how to deal with families and children in emergency situations. And I remember particularly that series of meetings. Really, coming away from it, I felt that we really had, the Holy See had made a difference in those discussions.
Why?
I don't know. Whether all of the stars were in alignment that day or those days, it just, at the end of the day, at the end of the week, and they were grueling meetings, I really felt satisfied coming out of that meeting that we had done something significant. The very last meeting that I attended before I came to Rome was a meeting on women and literacy. And I sat at the table with other delegates and formulated and had it included in the text, a literacy paragraph to make sure that all women and girls and then families wouldn't be excluded from these programs that they were developing. The paragraph was on literacy. The resolution itself was on development, social development, economic development, sustainable development, especially directed toward women. And we made sure that there was education and literacy provisions put in that. And again, it was one of those times when you walk out of there and you really feel we accomplished something today. Probably the highlight, if I can say, that there was one time in my experience at the UN. It was at the Johannesburg Summit on Sustainable Development in 2002. We had been supporting a number of issues in support of the developing countries. G77 is an organization within the member states of developing countries. It started out of the governments of 77 countries and China. Now it's 140 countries, the developing world. And our support had been recognized. They knew that we were a voice for them in the discussions. And on the last night, we had been discussing this document, this plan of action for many months, but it came down to the last night. And a compromise had been made. Language had been formulated on the last paragraphs. We finally had an agreement. We could bring this document forward. And the chairman of the Group of 77, came to us, came to the Holy See, came to me. I was sitting in the chair that day and said, "We won't move on this unless we have the Holy See's approval." And just, I was overwhelmed. But they saw that we had been so much involved in this that they wanted to make sure that if it was okay with us, if we were okay with the language, then it was finished, we'd move forward. And what a feeling that was to have the whole world watching me talk to this gentleman and with fingers crossed saying, "Come on, Holy See, accept this. Let's get out of here." And we did, and it's finished.
Now, the Holy See is fortunate to be able to rely on the expertise of a wide range of experts in all sorts of fields, lawyers, experts in water rights, all kinds of things. They're dedicating their time basically free of charge to the Holy See on many of these issues. Who are some of these people, and what sort of assistance can they provide?
Well, we had a number of people. Some of them were retired diplomats or people within the UN community. A number of lawyers in New York from the area. We also had people who traveled in great distances to attend some of these meetings. We didn't have the expertise to deal with the high finance, the really heavy financial issues, or the legal issues. Discussions of centering around the International Criminal Court, for instance, they're all being handled, have been handled down through the years by lawyers, by especially a group of lawyers who are involved with international law. Some of the women's issues, and they still continue. I know that there are some university professors who are involved with these questions at the UN. We would have and I'm going back a number of years, but we would have as many as 20 or 25 volunteers that would come to meetings during the various sessions, especially in the fall, because there would be many, many meetings going on, and the staff at the mission itself wouldn't have been able to cover what we needed to be present in. And so these people would give their time, a day, a week, maybe 2 weeks, at a shot, and attend these meetings, then follow the issue, write up a report, share with us the information that they were bringing back, but also to be able to speak that language at the table as those things were being discussed. They provided an invaluable service, not only to the mission, but to the Holy See.
It's really quite extraordinary. These are high-powered experts in many cases. Are they all Catholic, and were they able to make a difference on more than one occasion?
They were all Catholic, and I'm sure that, especially with the International Criminal Court and the legal issues discussions in the UN, some of these people were very well respected within the UN community. We had one lady who was a retired UN official who helped us with human rights things. She could walk into a room and you saw the respect that people had for her as from her background, that we were bringing somebody who wasn't just somebody filling the chair, but she was an important person in that meeting, and people respected that.
How long has the Holy See been an observer at the United Nations?
Formally, since 1964, so that's 44 years. And that role has increased over the years. At first, it was a very small representation, a Monsignor and a very small staff out of a very small office. Over the years, and that's increased, the role of the Holy See within the United Nations system has developed, and now I honestly don't even know how big of a staff they have in New York and how many volunteers come in and all of this, but it has, over the years that I was there, it continued to develop and grow.
When you were there, how many people worked there?
There were seven of us full-time, professional staff, a few secretaries then. Archbishop Martino then developed a program bringing in interns, and so we had three young people, university students or recent graduates, who would come in, especially for the General Assembly, and maybe these 20, 25 volunteers that would come in. So it was a rather large. Now, compared to a small country's delegation, it would probably be about average. I know some small countries, Andorra, for instance, there were three people on the staff. So we were more than that, but still much smaller than, you know, some other country that would be involved in many of the same issues that we were involved with.
I have an odd question for you. What would the world be like without an international body like the United Nations?
Well, it's not an odd question. And it's a question that's asked many times. And I think from the view of, let's get rid of the United Nations kind of thing, or what good is it? But the unfortunate thing is, the question that is difficult to ask, because we have a United Nations, and you can't, how do I want to say it? Look at the wars that have been avoided, the conflicts that have been avoided, because we were able to discuss, because there was an organization that was able to send in peacekeepers, an organization that could arrange for aid, for food aid, for medical aid, for whatever it might be, tsunami relief. These kind of things you have to put on the plus side of why the United Nations continues to exist. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights that we celebrate the 60th anniversary of in December this year, the recognition of human dignity, of universal rights, all of these things that we wouldn't have if there wasn't the United Nations, if there wasn't this organization that can bring people together, governments together, and talk and discuss the problems that not only are facing a region, but are facing the whole world community.
Monsignor James Reinhardt is an official with the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, a job he holds after working many years for the Holy See's permanent observer mission to the UN. For now, I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Laudator Jesus Christus.